Side 6, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, by Philip K. Dick. Continuing on page 200. Leave me something, Palmer, he thought to himself, please. A prayer, he realized, which had already been turned down. Palmer Eldritch had long ago acted. It was too late, and it always had been. Then I'll go ahead with litigation, Barney said to himself. I'll find my way back to Mars somehow, take the toxin, spend the rest of my life in the Interplan courts fighting you and winning. Not for Leo and PP layouts, but for me. He heard then a laugh. It was Palmer Eldritch's laugh, but it was emerging from himself. Looking down at his hands, he distinguished the left one, pink, pale, made of flesh, covered with skin and tiny, almost invisible hair, and then the right one, bright, glowing, spotless in its mechanical perfection, a hand infinitely superior to the original one, long since gone. Now he knew what had been done to him. A great translation, from his standpoint anyhow, had been accomplished, and possibly everything up to now had worked with this end in mind. It will be me, he realized, that Leo Bolero will kill. Me the monument will present a narration of. Now I am Palmer Eldritch. In that case, he thought after a while, as the environment surrounding him seemed to solidify and clear, I wonder how he is making out with Emily. I hope pretty badly. 12. With vast trailing arms, he extended from the Proxima Centaurus system to Terra itself, and he was not human. This was not a man who had returned, and he had great power. He could overcome death. But he was not happy, for the simple reason that he was alone. So he at once tried to make up for this. He went to a lot of trouble to draw others along the route he had followed. One of them was Barney Meyerson. Meyerson, he said conversationally, what the hell have you got to lose? Figure it out for yourself. You're washed up as it stands. No woman you love, a past you regret. You realize you took a decisively wrong course in your life and nobody made you do it. And it can't be repaired. Even if the future lasts for a million years, it can't restore what you lost by, so to speak, your own hand. You grasp my reasoning. No answer. And you forget one thing, he continued after waiting. She's devolved from that miserable evolution therapy that ex-Nazi-type German doctor runs in those clinics. Sure, she, actually her husband, was smart enough to discontinue the treatments right away, and she can still turn out pots that sell. She didn't evolve that much. But you wouldn't like her. You'd know. She'd be just a little more shallow, a shade sillier. It would not be like the past, even if you got her back. It'd be changed. Again he waited. This time there was an answer. All right. Where would you like to go? He continued then. Mars, I'll bet. Okay, then back to Terra. Barney Meyerson, not himself, said, No. I left voluntarily. I was through. The end had come. Okay, not Terra. Let's see. He pondered. Prox, he said. You've never seen the Prox system and the Proxers. I'm a bridge, you know, between the two systems. They can come here to the Sol system through me any time they want, and I allow them. But I haven't allowed them. But how they are eager, he chuckled. They're practically lined up, like the kiddies' Saturday afternoon movie matinee. Make me into a stone. Why? Barney Meyerson said, so I can't feel. There's nothing for me anywhere. You don't even like being translated into one homogeneous organism with me? No answer. You can share my ambitions. I've got plenty of them. Big ones. They make Leo's look like dirt. Of course, he thought, Leo will kill me not long from now, at least as time is reckoned outside of translation. I'll acquaint you with one, a minor one. Maybe it'll fire you up. I doubt it, Barney said. I'm going to become a planet. Barney laughed. You think that's funny? He felt furious. I think you're nuts. Whether you're a man or a thing from intersystem space, you're still out of your mind. I haven't explained, he said with dignity, precisely what I meant when I said that. What I mean is, I'm going to be everyone on the planet. You know what planet I'm talking about. Terra. Hell no. Mars. Why Mars? It's... He groped for the words. New, undeveloped, full of potential. I'm going to be all the colonists as they arrive and begin to live there. I'll guide their civilization. I'll be their civilization. No answer. Come on, say something. Barney said, How come if you can be so much, including a whole planet, I can't be even that plaque on the wall of my office at PP Layouts? He said, disconcerted. Okay, okay. You can be that plaque. What the hell do I care? Be anything you want. You took the drug. You're entitled to be translated into whatever pleases you. It's not real, of course. That's the truth. I'm letting you in on the innermost secret. It's an hallucination. What makes it seem real is that certain prophetic aspects get into the experience exactly as with dreams. I've walked into and out of a million of them, these so-called translation worlds. I've seen them all. And you know what they are? They're nothing. Like a captive white rat feeding electric impulses again and again to specific areas of his brain. It's disgusting. I see, Barney Meyerson said. You want to wind up in one of them, knowing this? After a time, Barney said, Sure. Okay, I'll make you a stone, put you by a seashore. You can lie there and listen to the waves for a couple of million years. That ought to satisfy you. You dumb jerk, he thought savagely. A stone, Christ! Am I softened or something? Barney asked then. In his voice were, for the first time, strong overtones of doubt. Is this what the Proxers wanted? Is this why you were sent? I wasn't sent. I showed up here on my own. It beats living out in dead space between hot stars, he chuckled. Certainly you're soft, and you want to be a stone. Listen, Meyerson, being a stone isn't what you really want. What you want is death. Death? You mean you didn't know? He was incredulous. Ah, come on. No, I didn't know. It's very simple, Meyerson. I'll give you a translation world in which you're a rotting corpse of a runover dog in some ditch. Think of it, what a goddamn relief it'll be. You're going to be me. You are me. And Leo Bolero is going to kill you. That's the dead dog, Meyerson. That's the corpse in the ditch. And I'll live on, he said to himself. That's my gift to you. And remember, in German, gift means poison. I'll let you die in my place a few months from now, and that monument on Sigma 14B will be erected, but I'll go on in your living body. When you come back from Mars to work at PP Layouts again, you'll be me. And so, I avoid my fate. It was so simple. Okay, Meyerson, he concluded, weary of the colloquy. Up and at 'em, as they say. Consider yourself dumped off. We're not a single organism anymore. We've got distinct, separate destinies again. And that's the way you wanted it. You're in a ship of Connor Freeman's leaving Venus, and I'm down in chickenpox prospects. I've got a thriving vegetable garden up top, and I get to shack up with Anne Hawthorne any time I want. It's a good life as far as I'm concerned. I hope you like yours equally well. And at that instant, he emerged. He stood in the kitchen of his compartment at Chicken Pox Prospects. He was frying himself a pan full of local mushrooms. The air smelled of butter and spices, and in the living room, his portable tape recorder played a Haydn symphony. Peaceful, he thought with pleasure. Exactly what I want, a little peace and quiet. After all, I was used to that out in intersystem space. He yawned, stretched with luxury, and said, I did it. Seated in the living room, reading a homeopape taken from the news service emanating from one of the UN satellites, Anne Hawthorne glanced up and said, You did what, Barney? Got just the right amount of seasoning in this, he said, still exulting. I am Palmer Eldritch, and I'm here, not there. I'll survive Leo's attack, and I know how to enjoy, use this life here, as Barney didn't or wouldn't. Let's see how he prefers it when Leo's fighter guns his merchant ship into particles, and he sees the last of a life bitterly regretted. In the glare of the overhead light, Barney Meyerson blinked. He realized after a second that he was on a ship. The room appeared ordinary, a combination bedroom and parlor, but he recognized it by the bolted down condition of the furniture, and the gravity was all wrong, artificially produced. It failed to duplicate Earth's. And there was a view out. Limited, no larger, in fact, than a comb of beeswax. But still, the thick plastic revealed the emptiness beyond, and he went over to fixedly peer. Saul, blinding, filled a portion of the panorama, and he reflexively reached up to click the black filter into use. And, as he did so, he perceived his hand. His artificial, metallic, superbly efficient mechanical hand. At once he stalked from the cabin and down the corridor until he reached the locked control booth. He rapped on it with his steel knuckles, and after an interval, the heavy, reinforced bulkhead door opened. Yes, Mr. Eldritch, the young blonde-haired pilot nodding with respect. He said, Send out a message. The pilot produced a pen and poised it over his notepad, mounted at the rim of the instrument board. Who to, sir? To Mr. Leo Bulero. To Leo Bulero, the pilot wrote rapidly. Is this to be relayed to Terra, sir? If so, no. Leo is near us in his own ship. Tell him... He pondered rapidly. You want to talk with him, sir? I don't want him to kill me. He answered, That's what I'm trying to say. And you with me, and whoever else is on this slow transport, this idiotically huge target. But it's hopeless, he realized. Somebody in Felix Blau's organization, carefully planted on Venus, saw me board this ship. Leo knows I'm here, and that's it. You mean business competition is that tough? The pilot said, taken by surprise. He blanched. Zoe Eldritch, his daughter in dirndle and fur slippers, appeared. What is it? He said, Leo's nearby. He's got an armed ship by UN permission. We were lured into a trap. We never should have gone to Venus. Hepburn Gilbert was in on it. To the pilot he said, Just keep trying to reach him. I'm going back to my cabin. There's nothing I can do here, he said to himself and started out. Hell, the pilot said. You talk to him. It's you he's after. He slid from his seat, leaving it pointedly vacant. Sighing, Barney Meyerson seated himself and clicked on the ship's transmitter. He set it to the emergency frequency, lifted the microphone, and said into it, You bastard, Leo. You've got me. You coaxed me out where you could get at me. You and that damned fleet of yours already set up and operating before I got back from Prox. You had the head start. He felt more angry than frightened now. We've got nothing on this ship. Absolutely nothing to protect ourselves with. You're shooting down an unarmed target. This is a cargo carrier. He paused, trying to think what else to say. Tell him, he thought, that I'm Barney Meyerson, and that Eldritch will never be caught and killed because he'll translate himself from life to life forever, and that in actuality you're killing someone you know and love? Zoe said, "Say something." "Leo," he said into the microphone, "let me go back to Prox, please." He waited, listening to the static from the receiver's speaker. "Okay," he said then. "I take it back. I'll never leave the Sol system, and you can never kill me, even with Hepburn Gilbert's help, or whoever it is in the UN you're operating in conjunction with." To Zoe, he said, "How's that? You like that?" He dropped the microphone with a clatter. "I'm through." The first bolt of laser energy nearly cut the ship in half. Barney Meyerson lay on the floor of the control booth, listening to the racket of the emergency air pumps wheezing into shrill, clacking life. "I got what I wanted," he realized. "Or at least what Palmer said I wanted. I'm getting death." Beyond his ship, Leo Bolero's UN model trim fighter maneuvered for the placing of a second, final bolt. He could see on the pilot's view screen the flash of its exhausts. It was very close indeed. Lying there, he waited to die. And then Leo Bolero walked across the central room of his compartment toward him. Interested, Anne Hawthorne rose from her chair, said, "So you're Leo Bolero. There are a number of questions, all pertaining to your product, Can-D." "I don't produce Can-D," Leo said. "I emphatically deny that rumor. None of my commercial enterprises are in any way illegal." "Listen, Barney, did you or did you not consume that..." He lowered his voice. Bending over Barney Meyerson, he whispered hoarsely, "You know." "I'll step outside," Anne said perceptively. "No," Leo grunted. He turned to Felix Blau, who nodded. "We realize you're one of Blau's people," Leo said to her. Again he prodded Barney Meyerson irritably. "I don't think he took it," he said half to himself. "I'll search him." He began to rummage in Barney's coat pockets and then in his inside shirt. "Here it is." He fished out the tube containing the brain metabolism toxin. Unscrewing the cap, he peered in. "Unconsumed," he said to Blau with massive disgust. So naturally, Fane heard nothing from him, he backed out. Barney said, "I didn't back out." "I've been a long way," he said to himself. "Can't you tell?" "Choosy," he said. "Very far." "Yeah, you've been out about 2 minutes," Leo said with contempt. "We got here just as you locked yourself in. Some fella, Norm something, let us in with his master key. He's in charge of this hovel, I guess." "But remember," Anne said, "the subjective experience with Choosy is disconnected to our time rate. To him it may have been hours or even days." She looked sympathetically in Barney's direction. "True?" "I died," Barney said. He sat up, nauseated. "You killed me." There was a remarkable, nonplussed silence. "You mean me?" Felix Blau asked at last. "No," Barney said. It didn't matter. At least not until the next time he took the drug. Once that happened, the finish would arrive. Palmer Eldritch would be successful, would achieve survival. And that was the unbearable part. Not his own death, which eventually would arrive anyhow, but Palmer Eldritch's putting on immortality. Grave, he thought, where's your victory over this thing? "I feel insulted," Felix Blau complained. "I mean, what's this about someone killing you, Meyerson? Hell, we roused you out of your coma. And it was a long, difficult trip here, and for Mr. Bolero, my client, in my opinion, a risky one. This is the region where Eldritch operates." He glanced about apprehensively. "Get him to take that toxic substance," he said to Leo, "and then let's get back to Terra before something terrible happens. I can feel it." He started toward the door of the compartment. Leo said, "Will you take it, Barney?" "No," he said. "Why not? Weariness, even patience. My life means too much to me. I've decided to halt in my atoning," he thought, "at last." "What happened to you while you were translated?" He rose to his feet. He barely made it. "He's not going to say," Felix Blau said at the doorway. Leo said, "Barney, it's all we've come up with. I'll get you off Mars, you know that, and Q-type epilepsy isn't the end of..." "You're wasting your time," Felix said, and disappeared out into the hall. He gave Barney one final envenomed glass. "What a mistake you made, pinning your hopes on this guy." Barney said, "He's right, Leo." "You'll never get off Mars," Leo said. "I'll never wangle a passage back to Terra for you, no matter what happens from here on out." "I know it." "But you don't care. You're going to spend the rest of your life taking that drug." Leo glared at him, baffled. "Never again," Barney said. "Then what?" Barney said, "I'll live here, as a colonist. I'll work on my garden up top, and whatever else they do, build irrigation systems and like that." He felt tired, and the nausea had not left him. "Sorry," he said. "So am I," Leo said, "and I don't understand it." He glanced at Anne Hawthorne, saw no answer there either, shrugged, then walked to the door. There he started to say something more, but gave up. With Felix Blau, he departed. Barney listened to the sound of them clanking up the steps to the mouth of the hovel, and then finally the sound died away and there was silence. He went to the sink and got himself a glass of water. After a time, Anne said, "I understand it." "Do you?" The water tasted good. It washed away the last traces of Chu-Z. "Part of you has become Palmer Eldritch," she said, "and part of him became you. Neither of you can ever become completely separated again. You'll always be..." "You're out of your mind," he said, leaning with exhaustion against the sink, steadying himself. His legs were too weak still. "Eldritch got what he wanted out of you," Anne said. "No," he said, "because I came back too soon. I would have had to be there another 5 or 10 minutes. When Leo fires his second shot, it'll be Palmer Eldritch there in that ship, not me. And that's why there is no need for me to derange my brain metabolism in a hasty crackpot scheme concocted out of desperation," he said to himself. "The man will be dead soon enough. Or rather, it will be." "I see," Anne said. "And you're sure this glimpse of the future you had during translation, it's valid?" Because he was not dependent on what had been available to him during his experience with the drug. In addition, he had his own precog ability. "And Palmer Eldritch knows it's valid, too," he said. "He'll do, is doing, everything possible to get out of it. But he won't. Can't." Or at least, he realized, it's probable that he can't. But here was the essence of the future, interlaced possibilities. And long ago he had accepted this, learned how to deal with it. He intuitively knew which timeline to choose. By that, he had held his job with Leo. "But because of this, Leo won't pull strings for you," Anne said. "He really won't get you back to Earth. He meant it. Don't you comprehend the seriousness of that? I could tell by the expression on his face. As long as he lives, he'll never..." "Earth," Barney said, "I've had." He, too, had meant what he had said, his anticipations for his own life which lay ahead here on Mars. If it was good enough for Palmer Eldritch, it was good enough for him, because Eldritch had lived many lives. There had been a vast, reliable wisdom contained within the substance of the man or creature, whatever it was. The fusion of himself with Eldritch during translation had left a mark on him, a brand for perpetuity. It was a form of absolute awareness. He wondered then if Eldritch had gotten anything back from him in exchange. "Did I have something worth his knowing?" he asked himself. Insights? Moods or memories or values? Good question. The answer, he decided, was no. Our opponent, something admittedly ugly and foreign that entered one of our race like an ailment during the long voyage between Terra and Prox, and yet it knew much more than I did about the meaning of our finite lives here. It saw in perspective. From its centuries of vacant drifting as it waited for some kind of life form to pass by which it could grab and become, maybe that's the source of its knowledge. Not experience, but unending, solitary brooding. And in comparison, I knew had done nothing. At the door of the compartment, Norm and Fran Shine appeared. "Hey, Meyerson, how was it? What'd you think of Choose E the second time around?" They entered, expectantly awaiting his answer. Barney said, "It'll never sell." Disappointed, Norm said, "That wasn't my reaction. I liked it, and a lot better than Candy. Except," he hesitated, frowned, and glanced at his wife with a worried expression, "there was a creepy presence, though, where I was. It sort of marred things," he explained. "Naturally, I was back." Fran interrupted, "Mr. Meyerson looks tired. You can give him the rest of the details later." Eyeing Barney, Norm Shine said, "You're a strange bird, Barney. You came out of it the first time and snatched this girl's bindle here, this Miss Hawthorne, and ran off and locked yourself in your compartment so you could take it. And now you say..." He shrugged philosophically. "Well, maybe you just got too much in your craw all at once. You weren't moderate, man. Me, I intend to try it again. Carefully, of course, not like you." Reassuring himself, he said loudly, "I mean it. I liked the stuff." "Except," Barney said, "for the presence that was there with you." "I felt it too," Fran said quietly. "I'm not going to try it again. I'm afraid of it, whatever it was." She shivered and moved closer to her husband. Automatically, from long habit, he put his arm around her waist. Barney said, "Don't be afraid of it. It's just trying to live like the rest of us are." "But it was so..." Fran began. "Anything that old," Barney said, "would have to seem unpleasant to us. We have no conception of age to that dimension, that enormity." "You talk like you know what it was," Norm said. "I know," Barney thought. "Because, as Anne said, part of it's here inside me. And it will, until it dies a few months from now, retain its portion of me incorporated within its own structure. So when Leo kills it," he realized, "it will be a bad instant for me. I wonder how it will feel." "That thing," he said, speaking to them all, especially to Norm Shine and his wife, "has a name which you'd recognize if I told it to you. Although it would never call itself that. We're the ones who've titled it. From experience at a distance over thousands of years. But sooner or later, we were bound to be confronted by it. Without the distance, or the years." Anne Hawthorne said, "You mean God?" It did not seem to him necessary to answer beyond a slight nod. "But evil?" Fran Shine whispered. "An aspect," Barney said. "Our experience of it, nothing more." "Or didn't I make you see that already?" he asked himself. "Should I tell you how it tried to help me in its own way, and yet how fettered it was, too, by the forces of fate which seemed to transcend all that live, including it as much as ourselves?" "Gee whiz," Norm said, the corners of his mouth turning down in almost tearful disappointment. He looked for a moment like a cheated small boy. 13. Later, when his legs had ceased collapsing under him, he took Anne Hawthorne to the surface and showed her the beginnings of his garden. "You know," Anne said, "it takes courage to let people down." "You mean Leo?" He knew what she meant. There was no dispute about what he had just now done to Leo and to Felix Blau and the whole PP Layouts and Candy organization. "Leo's a grown man," he pointed out. "He'll get over it. He'll recognize that he has to handle Eldritch himself, and he will." And he thought, "The litigation against Eldritch would not have accomplished that much. My precog ability tells me that, too." "Beats," Anne said. She had seated herself on the fender of an autonomic tractor and was examining packages of seeds. "I hate beets, so please don't plant any, even mutant ones that are green, tall, and skinny, and taste like last year's plastic doorknob." Were you thinking, he said, of coming here to live? No. Furtively, she inspected the homeostatic control box of the tractor and picked at the frayed, partially incinerated insulation of one of its power cables. But I expect to have dinner with your group every once in a while. You're the closest neighbor we have, such as you are. Listen, he said, that decayed ruin that you inhabit... He broke off. Identity, he thought. I'm already acquiring it in terms of this substandard communal dwelling that could use 50 years of constant, detailed repair work by experts. My hovel, he said to her, can lick your hovel any day of the week. What about Sunday? Can you do it twice, then? Sunday, he said, we're not allowed to. We read the scriptures. Don't joke about it, Anne said quietly. I wasn't. And he hadn't been, not at all. What you said earlier about Palmer Eldritch? Barney said, I only wanted to tell you one thing, maybe two at the most. First, that he, you know what I refer to, really exists, really is there, although not like we've thought and not like we've experienced him up to now, not like we'll perhaps ever be able to. And second, he hesitated, say it. He can't help us very much, Barney said. Some, maybe, but he stands with empty, open hands. He understands, he wants to help. He tries, but... it's just not that simple. Don't ask me why. Maybe even he doesn't know. Maybe it puzzles him, too. Even after all the time he's had to mull over it. And all the time he'll have later on, Barney thought, if he gets away from Leo Bolero. Human, one of us, Leo. Does Leo know what he's up against? And if he did, would he try anyhow? Keep on with his schemes? Leo would. A precog can see something that's foreordained. Anne said, what met Eldritch and entered him, what we're confronting, is a being superior to ourselves, and as you say, we can't judge it or make sense out of what it does or wants. It's mysterious and beyond us. But I know you're wrong, Barney. Something which stands with empty, open hands is not God. It's a creature fashioned by something higher than itself, as we were. God wasn't fashioned, and he isn't puzzled. I felt, Barney said, about him a presence of the deity. It was there. Especially in that one moment, he thought, when Eldritch shoved me, tried to make me try. Of course, Anne agreed. I thought you understood about that. He's here inside each of us, and in a higher life form, such as we're talking about, he would certainly be even more manifest. But let me tell you my cat joke. It's very short and simple. A hostess is giving a dinner party, and she's got a lovely 5-pound T-bone steak sitting on the sideboard in the kitchen, waiting to be cooked while she chats with the guests in the living room, has a few drinks and whatnot. But then she excuses herself to go into the kitchen to cook the steak, and it's gone. And there's the family cat in the corner, sedately washing its face. The cat got the steak, Barney said. Did it? The guests are called in. They argue about it. The steak is gone, all 5 pounds of it. There sits the cat, looking well-fed and cheerful. Weigh the cat, someone says. They've had a few drinks. It looks like a good idea. So they go into the bathroom and weigh the cat on the scales. It reads exactly 5 pounds. They all perceive this reading, and one guest says, okay, that's it. There's the steak. They're satisfied that they know what happened now. They've got empirical proof. Then a qualm comes to one of them, and he says, puzzled, but where's the cat? I heard that joke before, Barney said, and anyhow, I don't see its application. Anne said, that joke poses the finest distillation of the problem of ontology ever invented. If you ponder it long enough... Hell, he said angrily. It's 5 pounds of cat. It's nonsense. There's no steak if the scale shows 5 pounds. Remember the wine and the wafer, Anne said quietly. He stared at her. The idea for a moment seemed to come through. Yes, she said. The cat was not the steak. But the cat might be a manifestation which the stake was taking at that moment. The key word happens to be is. Don't tell us, Barney, that whatever entered Palmer Eldritch is God, because you don't know that much about him. No one can. But that living entity from intersystem space may, like us, be shaped in his image, a way he selected of showing himself to us. If the map is not the territory, the pot is not the potter. So don't talk ontology, Barney. Don't say is. She smiled at him hopefully to see if he understood. Someday, Barney said, we may worship at that monument. Not the deed by Leo Bolero, he thought, as admirable as it was, will be more accurately. That won't be our object. No, we'll all of us, as a culture, do as I already am tending toward. We'll invest it wanly, pitifully, with our conception of infinite powers. And we'll be right, in a sense, because those powers are there. But as Anne says, as to its actual nature... I can see you want to be alone with your garden, Anne said. I think I'll start back to my hovel. Good luck. And Barney... She reached out, took him by the hand, and held on to him earnestly. Never grovel. God, or whatever superior being it is we've encountered, wouldn't want that. And even if it did, you shouldn't do it. She leaned forward, kissed him, and then started off. You think I'm right? Barney called after her. Is there any point in trying to start a garden here? Or will we go the familiar way, too? Don't ask me. I'm no authority. You just care about your spiritual salvation, he said savagely. I don't even care about that anymore, Anne said. I'm terribly, terribly confused, and everything upsets me here. Listen. She walked back to him, her eyes dark and shaded, without light. When you grabbed me to take that bindle of choosy, you know what I saw? I mean, actually saw, not just believed? An artificial hand, and a distortion of my jaw, and my eyes. Yes, she said tightly. The mechanical, slitted eyes. What did it mean? Barney said, it meant that you were seeing into absolute reality, the essence beyond the mere appearance. In your terminology, he thought, what you saw is called stigmata. For an interval, she regarded him. That's the way you really are, she said then, and drew away from him with aversion manifest on her face. Why aren't you what you seem? You're not like that now. I don't understand. She added tremulously, I wish I hadn't told that cat joke. He said, I saw the same thing in you, dear, at that instant. You fought me off with fingers decidedly not those you were born with. And it could so easily slip into place again. The presence abides with us, potentially, if not actually. Is it a curse? Anne asked. I mean, we have the account of an original curse of God. Is it like that all over again? You ought to be the one who knows. You remember what you saw. All three stigmata, the dead artificial hand, the Jensen eyes, and the radically deranged jaw. Symbols of its inhabitation, he thought, in our midst, but not asked for, not intentionally summoned. And we have no mediating sacraments through which to protect ourselves. We can't compel it by our careful, time-honored, clever, painstaking rituals to confine itself to specific elements, such as bread and water or bread and wine. It is out in the open, ranging in every direction. It looks into our eyes, and it looks out of our eyes. It's a price, Anne decided, that we must pay for our desire to undergo that drug experience with that choosee. Like the apple, originally. Her tone was shockingly bitter. Yes, he agreed. But I think I already paid it. Or came within a hair of paying it, he decided. That thing, which we know only in its Terran body, wanted to substitute me at the instant of its destruction. Instead of God dying for man, as we once had, we faced for a moment a superior, the superior power, asking us to perish for it. Does that make it evil? He wondered. Do I believe the argument I gave Norm Schein? Well, it certainly makes it inferior to what came 2,000 years before. It seems to be nothing more or less than the desire of, as Anne puts it, an out-of-dust-created organism to perpetuate itself. We all have it. We all would like to see a goat or a lamb cut to pieces and incinerated instead of ourselves. Oblations have to be made, and we don't care to be them. In fact, our entire lives are dedicated to that one principle, and so is it. Goodbye, Anne said. I'll leave you alone. You can sit in the cab of that dredge and dig away to your heart's content. Maybe when I next see you, there'll be a completed water system installed here. She smiled once more at him briefly and then hiked off in the direction of her own hovel. After a time, he climbed the steps to the cab of the dredge which he had been using and started the creaky, sand-impregnated mechanism. It howled mournfully in protest. Happier, he decided, to remain asleep. This, for the machine, was the ear-splitting summons of the last trumpet, and the dredge was not yet ready. He had scooped perhaps a half mile of irregular ditch, as yet void of water, when he discovered that an indigenous life form, a Martian something, was stalking him. At once he halted the dredge and peered into the glare of the cold Martian sun to make it out. It looked a little like a lean, famished old grandmother on all fours, and he realized that this was probably the jackal creature which he had been warned repeatedly about. In any case, whatever it was, it obviously hadn't fed in days. It eyed him ravenously while keeping its distance, and then, projected telepathically, its thoughts reached him. So he was right. This was it. "May I eat you?" it asked, and panted avidly, slack-jawed. "Christ, no," Barney said. He fumbled about in the cab of the dredge for something to use as a weapon. His hands closed over a heavy wrench, and he displayed it to the Martian predator, letting it speak for him. There lay a great message in the wrench and the way he gripped it. "Get down off that contraption," the Martian predator thought, in a mixture of hope and need. "I can't reach you up there." The last was intended certainly to be a private thought retained in camera, but somehow it had gotten projected too. The creature had no finesse. "I'll wait," it decided. "He has to get down eventually." Barney swung the dredge around and started it back in the direction of chickenpox prospects. Groaning, it clanked at a maddeningly slow rate. It appeared to be failing with each yard. He had the intuition that it was not going to make it. "Maybe the creature's right," he said to himself. "It is possible I'll have to step down and face it." Spared, he thought bitterly, by the enormously higher life form that entered Palmer Eldritch that showed up in our system from out there, and then eaten by this stunted beast. The termination of a long flight, he thought. A final arrival that even 5 minutes ago, despite my precog talent, I didn't anticipate. Maybe I didn't want to, as Dr. Smile, if he were here, would triumphantly bleat. The dredge wheezed, bucked violently, and then, painfully contracting itself, curled up. Its life flickered a moment, and then it died to a stop. For a time, Barney sat in silence. Placed directly ahead of him, the old grandmother, jackal Martian flesh-eater, watched, never taking its eyes from him. "All right," Barney said, "here I come." He hopped from the cab of the dredge, flailing with the wrench. The creature dashed at him. Almost to him, 5 feet away, it suddenly squealed, veered, and ran past, not touching him. He spun and watched it go. "Unclean," it thought to itself. It halted at a safe distance and fearfully regarded him, tongue lolling. "You're an unclean thing," it informed him dismally. "Unclean," Barney thought. "How? Why?" "You just are," the predator answered. "Look at yourself. I can't eat you. I'd be sick." It remained where it was, drooping with disappointment and aversion, He had horrified it. "Maybe we're all unclean to you," he said. "All of us from Earth, alien to this world, unfamiliar." "Just you," it told him flatly. "Look at, your right arm, your hand. There's something intolerably wrong with you. How can you live with yourself? Can't you cleanse yourself some way?" He did not bother to look at his arm and hand. It was unnecessary. Calmly, with all the dignity that he could manage, he walked on, over the loosely packed sand, toward his hovel. That night, as he prepared to go to bed in the cramped bunk provided by his compartment at Chickenpox Prospects, someone rapped on his closed door. "Hey, Myerson, open up!" Putting on his robe, he opened the door. "That trading ship is back," Norm Schein, excited, grabbing him by the lapel of his robe, declared. "You know, from the Choosy people. You got any skins left? If so..." "If they want to see me," Barney said, disengaging Norm Schein's grip from his robe, "they'll have to come down here. You tell them that." He shut the door then. Norm loudly departed. He seated himself at the table on which he ate his meals, got a pack, his last of Terran cigarettes from the drawer, and lit up. He sat smoking and meditating, hearing above and around his compartment the scampering noises of his fellow hovelists. Large-scale mice, he thought, who have scented the bait. The door to his compartment opened. He did not look up. He continued to stare down at the table surface, at the ashtray and matches and pack of Camels. "Mr. Myerson," Barney said, "I know what you're going to say." Entering the compartment, Palmer Eldritch shut the door, seated himself across from Barney, and said, "Correct, my friend. I let you go just before it happened, before Leo fired the second time. It was my carefully considered decision, and I've had a long time to dwell on the matter, a little over 3 centuries. I won't tell you why." "I don't care why," Barney said. He continued to stare down. "Can't you look at me?" Palmer Eldritch said. "I'm unclean," Barney informed him.
"Who told you that?"
"An animal out in the desert, and it had never seen me before. It knew it just by coming close to me. While still 5 feet away," he thought to himself, "which is fairly far."
Maybe its motive."
"It had no goddamn motive. In fact, just the opposite. It was half dead from hunger and yearning to eat me. So it must be true."
"To the primitive mind," Eldritch said, "the unclean and the holy are confused, merged merely as taboo. The ritual for them, the..."
"Ah, hell," he said bitterly. "It's true and you know it. I'm alive. I won't die on that ship, but I'm defiled."
"By me?"
Barney said. "Make your own guess." After a pause, Eldritch shrugged and said, "All right. I was cast out from a star system. I won't identify it because to you it wouldn't matter. And I took up residence where that wild, get-rich-quick operator from your system encountered me. And some of that has been passed on to you, but not much. You'll gradually, over the years, recover. It'll diminish until it's gone. Your fellow colonists won't notice because it's touched them, too. It began as soon as they participated in the chewing of what we sold them."
"I'd like to know," Barney said, "what you were trying to do when you introduced Choosy to our people."
"Perpetuate myself," the creature opposite him said quietly. He glanced up then. "A form of reproduction?"
"Yes, the only way I can."
With overwhelming aversion, Barney said, "My God! We would all have become your children."
"Don't fret about that now, Mr. Myerson," it said, and laughed in a human-like, jovial way. "Just tend your little garden up top. Get your water system going. Frankly, I long for death. I'll be glad when Leo Bolero does what he's already contemplating. He's begun to hatch it, now that you've refused to take the brain metabolism toxin. Anyhow, I wish you luck here on Mars. I would have enjoyed it myself, but things didn't work out, and that's that."
Eldritch rose to his feet then.
"You could revert," Barney said. Resume the form you were in when Palmer encountered you. You don't have to be there inhabiting that body when Leo opens fire on your ship.
Could I?
Its tone was mocking.
Maybe something worse is waiting for me if I fail to show up there.
But you wouldn't know about that. You're an entity whose lifespan is relatively short. And in a short span, there's a lot less... It paused, thinking. Don't tell me, Barney said. I don't want to know. The next time he looked up, Palmer Eldritch was gone. He lit another cigarette. What a mess, he thought. This is how we act when finally we do contact at long last another sentient race within the galaxy. And how it behaves, badly as us, and in some respects much worse. And there's nothing to redeem the situation, not now. And Leo thought that by going out to confront Eldritch with that tube of toxin, we had a chance. Ironic. And here I am, without having even consummated the miserable act for the court's benefit, physically, basically, unclean. Maybe Anne can do something for me, he thought suddenly. Maybe there are methods to restore one to the original condition, dimly remembered, such as it was, before the late and more acute contamination set in. He tried to remember, but he knew so little about Neo-Christianity. Anyhow, it was worth a try. It suggested there might be hope, and he was going to need that in the years ahead. After all, the creature residing in deep space, which had taken the form of Palmer Eldritch, bore some relationship to God. If it was not God, as he himself had decided, then at least it was a portion of God's creation. So some of the responsibility lay on him. And it seemed to Barney, he was probably mature enough to recognize this. Getting him to admit it, though, that might be something else again. However, it was still worth talking to Anne Hawthorne. She might know of techniques for accomplishing even that. But he somehow doubted it, because he held a terrifying insight, simple, easy to think and utter, which perhaps applied to himself and those around him to this situation. There was such a thing as salvation, but not for everyone. On the trip back to Terra from their unsuccessful mission to Mars, Leo Bolero endlessly nitpicked and conferred with his colleague Felix Blau. It was now obvious to both of them what they would have to do. He's all the time traveling between a master satellite around Venus and the other planets, plus his domain on Luna, Felix pointed out in summation. And we all recognize how vulnerable a ship in space is. Even a small puncture can... He gestured graphically. We'd need the UN's cooperation, Leo said gloomily, because all he and his organization were allowed to possess were sidearms, nothing that could be used by one ship against another. I've got what may be some interesting data on that, Felix said, rummaging in his briefcase. Our people in the UN reach into Hepburn Gilbert's office, as you may or may not know. We can't compel him to do anything, but we can at least discuss it. He produced a document. Our Secretary General is worried about the consistent appearance of Palmer Eldritch in every one of the so-called reincarnations that users of Choose the experience. He's smart enough to correctly interpret what that implies. So if it keeps happening, undoubtedly we can get more cooperation from him, at least on a sub rosa basis. For instance, Leo broke in, Felix, let me ask you something. How long have you had an artificial arm? Glancing down, Felix grunted in surprise, and then, staring at Leo Bolero, who said, So do you, too. And there's something the matter with your teeth. Open your mouth and let's see. Without answering, Leo got to his feet and went to the men's room of the ship to survey himself in the floor-length mirror. There was no doubt of it. Even the eyes, too. Resignedly, he returned to a seat beside Felix Blau. Neither of them said anything for a while. Felix rattled his documents mechanically. Oh, God, Leo thought, literally mechanically. And Leo alternated between watching him and dully staring out the window at the blackness and stars of interplan space. Finally, Felix said, Sort of throws you at first, doesn't it?
It does, Leo agreed hoarsely. I mean, hey, Felix, what do we do?
We accept it, Felix said.
He was gazing with fixed intensity down the aisle at the people in the other seats. Leo looked and saw, too. The same deformity of the jaw, the same brilliant, unfleshly right hand. One holding a homeopape, another a book, a third its fingers restlessly tapping. On and on and on until the termination of the aisle and the beginning of the pilot's cabin. In there, too, he realized. It's all of us.
But I just don't quite get what it means, Leo complained helplessly. Are we in, you know, translated by that foul drug, and this is...
He gestured.
We're both out of our minds, is that it?
Felix Blau said. Have you taken Choosy?
No, not since that one intravenous injection on Luna.
Neither have I, Felix said. Ever.
So it's spread, without the use of the drug.
He's everywhere, or rather, it's everywhere.
But this is good.
This'll decidedly cause Hepburn Gilbert to reconsider the UN stand. He'll have to face exactly what this thing amounts to. I think Palmer Eldritch made a mistake. He went too far.
Maybe it couldn't help it, Leo said.
Maybe the damn organism was like a protoplasm. It had to ingest and grow. Instinctively, it spread out farther and farther. Until it's destroyed at the source, Leo thought. And we're the ones to do it, because I'm personally Homo sapiens evolvens. I'm the human of the future, right here, sitting in this seat now. If we can get the UN's help. I'm the protector, he said to himself, of our race. He wondered if this blight had reached Terra yet. A civilization of Palmer Eldritch's, gray and hollow and stooped and immensely tall, each with his artificial arm and eccentric teeth and mechanical, slitted eyes. It would not be pleasant. He, the protector, shrank from the envisioning of it. And suppose it reaches our minds, he asked himself. Not just the anatomy of the thing, but the mentality as well. What would happen to our plans to kill the thing?
Say, I bet this still isn't real, Leo said to himself. I know I'm right, and Felix isn't. I'm still under the influence of that one dose. I never came back out. That's what's the matter.
Thinking this, he felt relief, because there was still a real Terra untouched. It was only himself that was affected. No matter how genuine Felix beside him and the ship and the memory of his visit to Mars to see about Barney Meyerson seemed.
Hey, Felix, he said, nudging him. You're a figment. Get it? This is a private world of mine. I can't prove it, naturally, but...
Sorry, Felix said laconically. You're wrong.
Ah, come on. Eventually I'm going to wake up, or whatever it is you finally do when that miserable stuff is out of your system. I'm going to keep drinking a lot of liquids, you know, flush it out of my veins. He waved. Stewardess! He beckoned to her urgently. Bring us our drinks now. Bourbon and water for me.
He glanced inquiringly at Felix.
The same, Felix murmured. Except I want a little ice, but not too much, because that way when it melts, the drink is no good.
The stewardess presently approached, tray extended.
Yours is with ice?
She asked Felix. She was blonde and pretty, with green eyes the texture of good polished stones. And when she bent forward, her articulated spherical breasts were partially exposed. Leo noticed that, liked that. However, the distortion of her jaw ruined the total impression, and he felt disappointed, cheated. And now he saw the lovely, long-lashed eyes had vanished, been replaced. He looked away, disgruntled and depressed until she had gone. It was going to be especially hard, he realized, regarding women. He did not, for instance, anticipate with any pleasure the first sight of Ronnie Fugate.
You saw, Felix said as he drank his drink.
Yes, and it proves how quickly we've got to act, Leo said. As soon as we land in New York, we look up that wily, no-good nitwit Hepburn Gilbert.
What for? Felix Blau asked.
Leo stared at him, then pointed at Felix's artificial, shiny fingers holding his glass.
I rather like them now, Felix said meditatively. That's what I thought, Leo thought. That's exactly what I was expecting. But I still have faith I can get at the thing, if not this week, then next. If not this month, then sometime. I know it. I know myself now and what I can do. It's all up to me, which is just fine. I saw enough in the future not to ever give up, even if I'm the only one who doesn't succumb, who's still keeping the old way alive, the pre-Palmer Eldritch way. It's nothing more than faith and powers implanted in me from the start, which I can, in the end, draw on and beat him with. So in a sense, it isn't me. It's something in me that even that thing Palmer Eldritch can't reach and consume, because since it's not me, it's not mine to lose. I feel it growing. Withstanding the external, non-essential alterations, the arm, the eyes, the teeth, it's not touched by any of these three, the evil, negative trinity of alienation, blurred reality, and despair that Eldritch brought back with him from Proxima, or rather, from the space in between. He thought, we have lived thousands of years under one old-time plague already that's partly spoiled and destroyed our holiness, and that from a source higher than Eldritch. And if you can't completely obliterate our spirit, how can this? Is it maybe going to finish the job? If it thinks so, if Palmer Eldritch believes that's what he arrived here for, he's wrong. Because that power in me that was implanted without my knowledge, it wasn't even reached by the original ancient blight. How about that? My evolved mind tells me all these things, he thought. Those e-therapy sessions weren't in vain. I may not have lived as long as Eldritch in one sense, but in another sense I have. I've lived 100,000 years, that of my accelerated evolution, and out of it I've become very wise. I got my money's worth. Nothing could be clearer to me now. And down in the resorts of Antarctica, I'll join the others like myself. We'll be a guild of protectors, saving the rest. Hey, Blau, he said, poking with his non-artificial elbow the semi-thing beside him. I'm your descendant. Eldritch showed up from another space, but I came from another time. Got it? Felix Blau murmured. Look at my double dome, my big forehead. I'm a bubblehead, right? And this rind, it's not just on top, it's all over. So in my case, the therapy really took. So don't give up yet. Believe in me. Okay, Leo. Stick around for a while. There'll be action. I may be looking out at you through a couple of Jensen Lux Vid artificial-type eyes, but it's still me inside here, okay? Okay, Felix Blau said. Anything you say, Leo. Leo? How come you keep calling me Leo? Sitting rigidly upright in his chair, supporting himself with both hands, Felix Blau regarded him imploringly. Think, Leo. For Christ's sakes, think. Oh, yeah. Sobered, he nodded. He felt chastened. Sorry, it was just a temporary slip. I know what you're referring to. I know what you're afraid of. But it didn't mean anything. He added, I'll keep thinking like you say. I won't forget again. He nodded, solemnly promising. This ship rushed on, nearer and nearer Earth. End of The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch by Philip K. Dick. Read by Gary Tells in the studios of Potomac Talking Book Services Incorporated for the Library of Congress, May 1998. Published by Vintage Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, New York. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.